This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom, Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel and I am the editor of the TLS. Thea's here. Thea.
Hello.
Do you want to clear up anything about holidays?
Holidays? Oh, only to say that more often than not, when you say I am on holiday, I am in fact not on holiday, but rather working.
From home.
Quietly. From home. Very hard.
With a dog.
And I would, for example, never consider, for example, taking a day's holiday for my own birthday, which I believe...
I am doing that tomorrow. And it's quite nice. My wife would say in response to that is there is like a 3.5 week Easter holiday and I'm taking a day to do it. So I lose on both ends of that argument. We do need to clear up tuna melts as well.
Wait, there's nothing to clear up there. They are just wrong.
Tuna on pizza?
Absolutely not.
I mean, that's wrong. In Italy, not. If you went for a pizza... What's the acceptable thing to have on it?
Loads of different.
Oh, wait, so Italian wouldn't look down on you if you had, you know, Hawaiian pizza.
Yeah, they would on that, definitely, absolutely, and rightly so. Because what's
pizza.
Wrong with you?
I love Hawaiian. Have you ever had a Hawaiian pizza?
No.
You've never had it.
No.
But sweet pineapple, salty ham. No,
it's a completely different thing. No. Put it on a cocktail what's your stick or something.
Yeah, I do like that.
Well, there you go.
What's your pizza of choice, Sue?
I am a purist. I'm a margherita.
Oh, for God's
yeah.
sake.
No, well, why?
I don't know. It's so boring, isn't it?
No. If the ingredients are good, then that's all you need.
Okay. Are you about to say or something, though? You're about to say one more and then...
No, really. Just margherita. A margherita, yeah.
All right. Even if you say it in an Italian accent, it doesn't make it less boring. It's still just a pizza with nothing on it. Right. Anyway, make sure you're subscribing to the TLS so you can read our tech special this week, known internally as the Sex Robots issue. Which is true, isn't it? We have been saying that.
So refined.
It is. It's incredibly fun. We have an extract from Ian McEwan's new novel, Machines Like Me, and Ian will be speaking to Toby Lichtig for this podcast next week. But this week, yes, we'll talk about sex robots and how optimistic we should be about their rise. Is it a cure for loneliness or simply a masturbation receptacle for creeps? I have to say that that was my own contrast, not that of Alice Block, who's in the studio to explain more. Keeping matters sociological, we'll explore the youth justice system with Shauneen Lamb. Why is the UK so bad at it, and maybe even worse than the US? She'll tell us. And our very own George Berridge has been reading up on Max Porter. He likes booze and Moby Dick. George, that is. But we'll find out what he makes of Porter's second book, Lanny, and the theatrical adaptation of his first.
What does a good youth justice system look like? In a wide-ranging piece in this week's paper, Shauneen Lamb ponders precisely this question, providing an overview of the youth justice system in England and Wales and comparing it to America's. Recent developments seem to be taking the two systems in opposite directions. While in England we're doubling down on the tough tactics that bring more and more young people into the criminal system, the US, famously tough on crime, with the mass incarceration rates to prove it, appears ever so tentatively to be taking a more enlightened approach, drawing on brain science and a more sympathetic understanding of social factors including poverty. Shauneen takes in two recent books in the field, Why Children Follow Rules by Tom R. Tyler and Rick Trinkner, and Miller's Children, Why Giving Teenage Killers a Second Chance Matters for All of Us by James Garbarino. Not to mention introducing me, at least, to a new term, ephebophobia, fear of the teenager, which has a great deal to do.
Is it great? Is that a great phrase?
It is. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful word. Here to tell us more is Shauneen Lamb. Hello, Shauneen.
Hi, nice.
You like the word ephebophobia?
I think it's a great word.
It's a fantastic
I'm not sure
word.
I can break down its etymology.
We won't ask you to. Instead, and I don't know whether this is any easier, if you could start by giving us a brief sketch of the current state of the system in England and Wales, because it took me by surprise, I must say.
Well, I suppose the thing that's really interesting in terms of the UK is where we're geographically located is also kind of similar to the justice system that we inhabit. So, although today, as we speak, we're a part of Europe, our justice system very much looks like the American justice system. And in lots of ways, there's similarities. Obviously, jury trials and things like that came about in the US from the British being there. But where the US in the late 90s became what they call their mass incarceration crisis, the UK kind of tentatively followed. And now it seems the US is rowing back from that, yet we're continuing down the path of criminalising children and young people.
And we're outliers in that the age of criminal responsibility in England and Wales is 10. It's incredibly low. In Italy, it's 15. In Germany, it's 14.
Yeah. The average in Europe is 14. It's incredibly low, and there's no public appetite really for raising that. But what it means is that you can have a child as young as 10 going through a jury trial.
And what is there? Has anyone ever done scientific or psychological or any form of testing to work out what actually an appropriate age of responsibility is? Or is it just a kind of custom and practice?
Well, it's a really interesting question because people talk about this in light of lowering the voting age to 16 and when can you actually participate in civic society. So we have a fixed age of majority in this country of 18, which is when you're an adult, but then varying ages below that. So, for example, driving or smoking cigarettes or having sex. But all of those are much higher than 10. And so we're saying, for example, that young people are unable to make a rational decision as to whether or not to have sex with someone until they're 16, yet they can engage in a whole criminal process from the age of 10.
And is that a historical thing that we've wanted to keep it low? Because people ultimately can't get into their heads that a crime doesn't have a conscious act behind it, and we need to have a conscious act in some way.
Yeah, I think it's around that idea that people know what they're doing is wrong, that children know what they're doing is wrong, which is, of course, often true. But can they be held to account to the consequences, and do they rationalise a whole process for doing that? The reason we set the age, say, of sexual consent at 16 is because we think it takes the maturity of a 16-year-old to understand the consequences of what might happen, even though people will be aware of what sex is from much younger. So it seems like a real anomaly.
And also, Spain, I don't know what it is in Italy, but the age of consent in Spain, for example, is much lower. I think it's like it's 12 or 13.
Yeah.
So it's strange that we would go in the opposite direction for this.
It's from a historical perspective where we used to criminalise children from the age of 8. And it's increasingly Scotland are about to raise the age of criminal responsibility, and Ireland have. But here it stubbornly sits at 10.
And do you say there seems to be no appetite to change that?
No, there's no political appetite to change it whatsoever. I think the belief is that there are very few children that enter into the court system, but there are, and this is the part that I find very difficult, a lot of children who come into the police station. So they may not end up getting charged or going to court, but the whole experience of being in a police station is extremely traumatic for a child.
And so instead we're seeing a continuation in England and Wales, at least, of this kind of this tough on crime thing. So, and a lot of that we owe to New Labour, don't we?
Yeah, it has to be said that it did peak around 2010, the number of entrants into the youth justice system. So right at the end of New Labour, when I think it was about 160,000. And that has gone down now to 60,000. But the problem we're seeing is it's still people with very complex mental health needs now that are entering, or they're still being caught up in the police system and then being diverted out and not going to court.
But ultimately, we are, in this area, a right-wing country. And what Tony Blair
recognised. So remember, Jamie Bulger happened just before Blair, I think. And John Major said, we should be less understanding, we should be less forgiving about the causes of crime. And Blair agreed with him.
Because tough on crime, tough on the causes of crime.
Trying to compete on that point. I read a story that at the same time as Jamie Bulger happened, in Norway, two young boys stripped a little girl, assaulted her, and then left her, and she died of hypothermia. So they killed her. And I think 2 weeks later, they were back in school and they were in a process, a sort of health-led process of rehabilitation. Whereas what happened to Jamie Bulger's killers was very, very different. That it seems to me a societal thing that we cannot stand softness in the face of crime. And we associate health or mental health or other approaches to this problem as a softness.
And I think that underpinning all of that has to be a belief that deterrence is a factor in crime, because otherwise you wouldn't have such harsh penalties. And all the science and evidence shows that deterrence really isn't a factor when people are committing acts which are what they call in the research kind of hot acts. They're not rational, cold decision-making acts, that they are
impulsive
in the heat of the moment. And I think somehow it really shocks us as a nation when children do horrible, you know, really awful things. And so we have therefore this idea of two types of young people, the good civic young person and then these evil children or young people. And the thing that I think is most fascinating about that is that there is no voice for their experience in that. We only hear the voice of the adults in these debates.
Not least because they're not named in the case of the Bulger killers. Their identities are protected for forever.
Yeah.
So we're never going to find. I mean, we know that one of them seems to have been rehabilitated and one of them still commits awful acts, but that's all we're allowed to know about it.
But if you looked even just today, I don't know if you saw in the news, there was some violence within Feltham Young Offenders Institute over the last couple of days. And very strong reports from the Prisoners Office Association, we stand by them, this is not tolerable, which is all perfectly right. But no one's hearing the other side of why this violence erupted from the mouths of the people that were involved. So they're in totally voiceless element of society.
And this gets at something that you put very well in your piece, which is the different spheres, the competing rule systems, and how you can't really reconcile them. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, I think this is the thing that really fascinates me as someone who works within the youth justice system, and I think resonates with everybody because they have been a teenager. And it's whose rules do you abide by when you are making decisions? So what's interesting in the Tyler and Trinkner book is they talk about this idea of a three kind of legitimate systems: the school system that has its own rules, your family system that may have different rules and have some morality to them, and the legal system. By that they mean contact with the police and more formal systems. But what's I felt very not explored it, because it's often the most dominant thing for teenagers, is the peer system. And what really happens, if we remember ourselves being teenagers and children, how we were perceived by our peers was so much more important than whether the teacher thought we'd put in a good piece of work, whether our parents thought we were well behaved and nice. And the systems that we've created fail to acknowledge the preeminence of this peer system in those years.
And they presumably fail to distinguish between a certain amount of necessary rule testing, which is a process of growing up, versus rule breaking, which is felt to be criminal. And when you have ASBO systems or systems like that, you don't really draw much of a distinction between the two. Someone acts in a stupid teenage way, they're automatically a criminal. And that might push them into a world where the rules are being broken more regularly rather than actually taking them from that.
And I think that's, again, that point that I made earlier about the young people's voice not being present in any of this. A stark example that I put in the piece was around this idea of snitches getting stitches. This idea that young people have that they snitching on a peer group is a real violation of the code of conduct. Yet the court system expects you to tell the truth, whole truth, nothing but the truth. And if you don't, you will feel the weight of the criminal justice system. So these two competing spheres are in conflict, and no one's recognizing the reason why people may not be abiding by the rules is they're abiding by a different set of rules. And until I think we bring the voice of children and young people into those other systems, we're always going to have them clashing with each other.
And we get some of that in James Garbarino's book, although the people he speaks to are no longer children. They were incarcerated when they were children for crimes committed then. What's his project there? What's he sort of hoping to achieve?
So, I mean, he's got an extraordinary insight into people who killed as children. So the reason why the book's called Miller's Children is a case called Miller versus Alabama that went to the US Supreme Court, where the court decided in a 5-4 ruling that children couldn't get mandatory life without parole sentences for killing, which they had been able to get prior to this. It was 2012, the decision in Miller. And then subsequently, there was a case after that called Montgomery versus Louisiana that said everybody who'd been given a life without parole sentence as a child could have a resentencing hearing to see if it was still appropriate. And James Garbarino acts as a psychologist in those cases, going in to tell the court whether the person who was given a life without parole sentence is rehabilitated enough to re-enter into society. Some of those men and young women, and a lot of the lawyers I know in the States who work on these cases, have been in adult prisons since they were children for over 20 or 30 years. One of the cases that Garbarino studies, the guys spent longer in prison than he ever spent out in the outside world.
And how
world.
Can they possibly be rehabilitated in that circumstance? Because if you take a child and put them in a... I mean, American correctional facilities aren't necessarily places of great rehabilitation often.
I suppose what they mean in that context is, are they safe to be reintegrated into society?
And are they?
Well, of course, many of them are. In my experience of working with people on death row and serving life sentences in the States, you know, there are really lots of people who are running civic. The prisons are being run a lot by the prisoners themselves. These trustees are societies within the gates that are, you know, running efficiently and effectively by a lot of times the prisoners themselves. Now, of course, and Garbarino points that out, there are some people for whom rehabilitation may be impossible. Perhaps there's mental health problems or serious violence. But I think in general, he says, and that's borne out by the scientific evidence, that children grow out of their bad behaviour.
And this has been the most... One of the authors calls it an explosion of technology.
Yeah.
That has changed the way that certainly in America, perhaps more than here so far, things are being done.
So what's really interesting is that Bell obviously identified this in 1904, this age crime curve, which he showed that drop-off happened around
Stanley
about
Hall.
Stanley Hall, sorry.
Yeah.
It's a bell curve.
Yeah.
It's a bell curve. Is that where the word bell curve comes from? Yeah. So when does the drop-off happen, sorry?
Around about 25.
Really?
And that was perceived to be, you know, hormonal and settling down. What's been fascinating in the last 20 years is the evolution of MRI and fMRI, which is the film moving image of MRI, which shows which part of the brain children and adolescents use when they're making decisions. So it's not saying they can't make decisions. What it shows is that they use a different part of their brain when they're making decisions. And one of the things that's really interesting is around, and none of the ages are obviously, they vary depending on adolescent development. But there's a period of time where the frontal cortex, which is where we make rational decisions, is entirely pruned back like a rose bush, ready for the kind of rewiring. So I suppose the idea is that beforehand, children have this generalist absorbing knowledge that they learn about the world around them, and then they're going to get specific. And it ties in with the idea of people choosing GCSEs or A-levels. Their knowledge goes down one direction, but exactly like a rose bush. Now, the science is here in the UK. There's Professor Sarah Jane Blakemore does a lot of work around this. What we haven't seen is the criminal justice system accepting this science as valid.
And ultimately, the criminal justice system is a political entity, not an evidence-based entity, because it has to serve political masters who don't want to seem soft on crime. So the chances of that shifting is presumably relatively poor.
Surely that's the same in America, though.
Yeah, I think what happened in America is in these series of judgments is that, people like the American Medical Association, the American Psychiatric Association submitted amicus briefs. So from their scientific basis saying, we're not taking either side. We are independently showing you the science from our scientific knowledge. And the court accepted that because when you look at the facts of any of these cases, they're all pretty horrific. Yeah. And by the very nature they are. But the science kind of speaks for itself. And I think there's a real opportunity here in the UK for the judiciary and the politicians to recognise this kind of adolescent brain development as really game changing.
Shaneen Lam, thank you very much. We're going to have to leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Kate Devlin's new book is called Turned On, Science, Sex and Robots, and is, according to Alice Block, an upbeat work of tempered optimism from someone who declares herself to be a pro-sex feminist with some radical leanings. The books offer a history of the human desire to get intimate with the inanimate, from ancient dildos to sex toys initiated remotely. Devlin's own preferred sex toy of the future will be changeable at whim, apparently. Perhaps one day a bed of breasts, another day a series of vibrating and moving penises that talk dirty to me. Maybe sometimes both. Which is quite an image if you pause, and maybe you don't want to pause to reflect on it, but it is quite an image. There you go. So are sex robots harbingers of liberation or dystopia? Alice Block is here with us. Alice, hello.
Hello.
We'll get to the changeable at whim sex robot at some point, no doubt. Is there a thesis of this book? Is there an argument?
Well, I mean, for me, there is. I think, you know, she ends on this point that really kind of another sex robot future is possible. It's not predetermined. It's not pre-programmed. And for me, that's kind of the overall thesis, I suppose.
So what's what's the standard sex robot future? It's just a load of creeps masturbating in a complicated fashion.
Yeah, I guess there's a lot of moral panic around the subject. There's a lot of ideas about kind of who might own these things, kind of the disaster that they might kind of wreak upon sort of human relationships and interactions and that kind of thing. I guess that's the kind of everyday, almost kind of tabloid-esque thesis. It might have been my thesis, I guess, before reading this book.
It may still be mine, actually, until the end of this podcast.
I mean, it's funny sometimes in reviewing a book, you surprise yourself that actually kind of your opinion isn't necessarily what you think it is.
Which is good in a way, isn't it? That's a sign of a good book, potentially.
Yeah, absolutely. So her thesis to me is that kind of the future of sex robots and sex technology is not necessarily disastrous. It could kind of bring people together. It could create a kind of a better future of intimacy, a more inclusive kind of intimate world. Etc.
I guess,
taking a step back, I guess if we think of sex robots as these kind of pornified, hypersexualized gynoids, these fembots that she talks about in the book, and you know, I think for a lot of people that's kind of quite rightly unappealing. I know that it is to me. And she talks about how they're, you know, they're often kind of framed in what she calls, I think, the mono-heteronormative sort of gaze. You know, it's for straight people, it's often women, as in, you know, the robots are women, etc. Yeah. All of that stuff doesn't necessarily appeal to me, probably not to you guys, I don't know. But maybe, you know, if we can think differently about sex robots and sex technology and kind of take a leaf out of sort of the sex toy design book, at least this is how I understand what she's saying, then maybe kind of we can have a more interesting kind of abstracted, multi-sensory, sinuous, interesting,
hence
multi-textured
duvet of breasts.
Hence all of that kind of
penises.
Lots of, vibrating penises and things like that that I've never had to write about before.
It seems that would have to be quite some change of direction in a sense, though, wouldn't it? Because even when you just think about the earliest robots, they tend to have been designed to be assistants or to just, you know, show what can be done. They're always women. It's always default women, isn't it? Even if you just think of the kind of the clunkiest things, they tend to be female form.
I don't know. I mean, okay, so I'm no robot expert, although I slightly feel it having read this book for so long. But I guess looking at, you know, pictures online of these kind of early humanoid ones, they're kind of genderless to me, I suppose. But then you get these I forget the male term, but then you get the kind of the gynoid, the female one. But I guess if you think of, you know, there are robots that perform all sorts of functions in, I guess, the military, in kind of cleaning and all that kind of thing, swimming pool cleaners, that kind of thing. They don't, they serve a function, but they don't need to look like people. And they definitely don't need to look like sort of, you know, porn stars.
I mean, thank God they don't. Imagine that.
Yeah, imagine if they did. Yeah.
But it's interesting, in our minds, we all think of a fembot, they are a very pornified thing, aren't they? They're massive boobs and sort of big vacant eyes and that sort of thing. Is there a history of sex toys worth knowing? Because you might not know this, Alice. We had Elaine Showalter, the famous feminist, on our podcast, and she did a piece, do you remember this theory, where she said in 1844, it was a critical year in sociology because vulcanized rubber was invented, and that led to condoms, and it also led to sex toys. And actually, in terms of sexual mores, that was when the significant change happened, that sort of mid-Victorian period. Does Kate Devlin talk about the history of sex toys?
She does. That doesn't ring a bell, that particular example, that date in 1844 or whatever it is.
It's stuck in my mind when Elaine Showalter did it.
I think, I wish... Yeah, she does talk about the history of sex toys, I suppose. And I think I have this line in my review that, you know, we've been intimate with the inanimate for a very long time. She talks about the kind of ancient story of, I hope I say her name correctly, Laodamia, who her husband died at Troy, and then she kind of created this bronze likeness of him and was later seen interacting with it, so to speak.
Is bronze likeness a euphemism?
yeah, I'm guessing. I don't know whether it was a likeness of entirely him or just parts of him. But yeah, so, you know, it goes way back. She also talks about this this kind of finding, I think, in a cave in Germany of this obviously kind of phallic object that's, you know, could be over 25,000 years old. All sorts of things. She one thing I love, and it's sad to hear that it might not be true, is this rumour. She talks about how there's a rumour that Cleopatra invented the vibrator, and that it was, I think, some kind of husk full of bees or something like this.
Oh, I've heard.
Well, there we go.
That's too good to check.
Yeah,
let's not think that too.
So I mean, the best I can say there is I think it goes way back, and so that's. Yeah, this is what I mean by kind of tempered techno-optimism as well. I think she's trying to say, you know...
This isn't as frightening as all
that. This kind of what fresh hell is this? Well, it's not really a fresh hell. And it might not even be hell.
Yeah.
She's very much pushing towards more abstract ways of taking this, more abstract directions. So teleodildonics and...
Teledildonics.
That is a great word.
Yeah, she has it in a little subheading, I think, a subchapter called Teledil What Now or something, which is part of her sort of witty style. But yeah, I mean...
And to be clear, that is enables sex toy users to feel sensations initiated remotely, and you say this brings new meaning to the long-distance relationship.
Yeah, I'm probably not the first to use that
this
line.
This is the idea that you might be able to pleasure your partner remotely.
Remotely, yes. And, you know, then we get to the whole question of smart sex toys and all of that. But on your question, I think, yes, she does say, hey, sex robots don't need to look like these kind of pornified fembots. You know, we might never make a sex robot that looks realistically human. So why, when we've got all this amazing technology around us now, are we still kind of trying to get there when we might never get there? So I think, yeah, she does, when you look at, say, the sex tech hackathons that she talks about and the workshops she's running, she's really interested in the design element and doing something different. She is also saying, look, even the human-like ones, yeah, they're not great, but we don't need to have a super panic about them, you know, in the same way that, say, sex doll users, they're not always who we think we are.
Is
they're
that
not
true?
Who we stereotype them as. I mean I don't know. it's not my scene. But yeah, she does talk briefly in the book about how, you know, maybe they have been a slightly not misrepresented, but there's a narrow understanding of the kind of the internet shut-in and all of this.
But is there an argument that, I wonder if there's a male-female split here, which is that males historically are seen as requiring a certain amount of visual stimulation in a way that women are less. I think there's an argument I've heard. Mm. So there's a kind of there's all sorts of ethical issues raised with this. Are these robots going to become a version of the male gaze? Because they'll be made predominantly by men, predominantly for men. So the image that will be created won't be something kind of abstract and a series of sort of sensual levers. Mm. It'll be someone who looks tottering, with big boobs, because
thus far that has certainly been the case. I mean,
yeah, and she would stress that we're really in early days here. So I mean, I think I can imagine it was a nightmare writing this book, probably, because as she's writing, probably she's getting all sorts of alerts of new things changing and coming out. But yeah, we're just at the beginning here. But yeah, for now, definitely, I think she would say the ones that are out there, the kind of early experiments in the field, or whatever I call them, these proto sex bots, they are made in the male gaze. And I think that's something that she would like to see expanded, and, you know, made more inclusive.
There's one fascinating yet awful ethical area that you raised, but I do think this is important to mention. She, 'cause it almost seems to me that she explores this and then feels she has to say it's wrong, even whether I got the sense from how you were describing it, maybe she would like to explore this further, which is the idea of childlike sex robots, which she calls abhorrent. But she also says that they might have a therapeutic value for treating paedophiles. Now, we all understand the abhorrent side of that argument, because it's, and there must be an argument that if a person has sex with a robot, it might make them feel more likely to have sex with a person in real life. So it could break down a barrier that's being kept up.
Yeah.
But equally, there's an argument about giving a safe place for people with certain inclinations so they're not harming actual people, I presume, is the counter argument to that.
Yeah. And I think my understanding is that she's not launching this debate or anything like that. I mean, this is part of a discussion where she's talking about the various kind of ethical, legal issues raised by the subject. And yeah, this is one of them. And I have to say, when I came across it in the book, it was all going quite well until then. And I was thinking, this is quite a straightforward, you know, read. And then you see that and you kind of get the heebie-jeebies, because it's, yeah, your instinctive reaction is like, oh, God, you know. And she rightly says, you know, I think twice she says, yep, the idea is abhorrent. But yeah, she does also say, but there is a lack of evidence as to its therapeutic potential. Yeah, I've got the quote here, particularly as an outlet or proxy for paedophiles in order to restrict offences to the virtual or robotic realm. I think she makes the point that paedophiles aren't necessarily criminals. So this is kind of a condition in a way.
That's a very strong argument. There's arguments about, can you treat it chemically, which happens in some countries? Can you treat it by therapy rather than by criminalisation? I mean, the abhorrent point is so strong, it seems impossible to get past that.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that robots generally are going to become an ethical prism, really, aren't they? Because ultimately, all sorts of decisions that you can do when you create these robots about sentience and about relations and about mutuality and things like that, they're going to become crystallized if you're creating someone that you want to make look like a human being. It does feel like an area that's not just about sex, it's going to be about all sorts of other areas.
Yeah, and sort of selectivity, if you can make a choice. It's almost like eugenics in a way. You can choose exactly what you want rather than be confronted with the variety of the world and just see what happens.
Yeah, absolutely. And there is that debate around, you know, whether they will kind of ruin human relationships, because why would you, you know, go out with a fallible human when you could kind of, you know, get your perfect sex robot that's exactly micro-controllable, programmable, whatever.
And is that possible?
You can take back to the shop. You can't take your partner back to the shop.
Do you get a sense that from reading this book that's a possibility, that there is a sort of utopia or dystopia, depending on how you look at it, that where... Because sex dolls haven't changed people's relations to any. I mean, but they are.
No.
But maybe because they're just so crap.
Well, I think she would argue that this fear that, you know, sex robots are going to ruin human relationships, you know, that's understandable. But actually, and she kind of puts herself in dialogue with a colleague of hers that she agrees with in the book. And, you know, they both kind of seem to be saying, well, actually, it's a different category of relationship, a bit like the sex doll thing, you know, and especially at this stage where, as far as I can see, they are, you know, really not close to being indistinguishable from humans. I don't think we're yet at that stage where, you know, humans are replaceable by sex robots. But yeah, you're right, it absolutely does raise these sort of fears and concerns, and she does a good job of addressing them, I think.
And the reason we've just got this sort of tech issue is, I think we're going to look more at it generally over time. Do you think we're just slowly waking up to, because, you know, say, oh, humans aren't replaceable, but I'm not sure you'd argue, you'd have thought social media would have got to the point it's got to, or our relationship with, where we give up so much of ourselves online. 10 years ago or 5 years ago, you'd have said, well, I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't put all that on my online. And yet we've all kind of crept into it. So it's one of the lessons on all of this, that things can move fairly quickly.
I think so. Yeah. But on that, you know, if you look at, say, social media, obviously, I mean, you could argue, I mean, I'm no techie really, but the algorithms have their own power or whatever after a while, you know. But actually, I think the message that I take away from this book, at least, is that the development of technology is really in human hands, at least for now, you know. So it's not, it's especially while sex robots and robots aren't sentient, you know, we're still, relatively speaking, in control. And, you know, it's not up to the robots to develop their own ethical code for their own development. It's up to us.
But we've not done that. I mean, one of the things that I'm struck by is that I remember going to a thing at Google about, this must have been 4 years ago, and we were talking about AI. And they said, what do you think is the rule? What are the rules about AI in the world, do you think? And here, by the way, here are the centres of AI around the world. Oh, look, there's one in North Korea, there's one in China, there's one in Russia. What do you think the international laws are about AI? And there aren't any, and there still aren't any.
Gosh.
Because everything is kind of self-regulatory. There's kind of some principles of AI. There are principles that everyone should follow. But it's not a kind of fixed law that's enforced by any agency, because it will often cut across international boundaries anyway. So there's, I don't want to be pessimistic, but the fear, I suppose, is that lots of different people in different parts of the world are taking sentience and an AI forward. Can we really? I mean, I don't trust anyone to do anything.
It sounds like Kate Devlin sort of puts her finger on the Dr. Frankenstein problem when she looks at a real doll, doesn't she? And she finds herself torn between feeling, you know, oh my God, this must not happen, and also being completely amazed and impressed by what humans can achieve.
So
there's that push and the artistry. So there's the push and pull of the thing, and that's where we're at now. We've realised in all of technology how much we can do. And then it's the question of, but do we want to do that? Do we want to do that?
How much should we?
Exactly.
And what's the real damage done if we do as well? I think she addresses that question quite level-headedly.
Well, it sounds like a very interesting book for the now.
Yeah, exactly.
thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you so much. That's so interesting. Thank you very much. Max Porter is both simultaneously lauded and oddly yet perhaps not well known enough. He's won Young Writer of the Year awards, the Dylan Thomas Prize, but he doesn't have his own Wikipedia page. His first novel, Grief is the Thing with Feathers, came out to much acclaim in 2015 and tells the story of a Ted Hughes scholar coming to terms with the death of his wife and the mother of his children. It's now been made into a play on at the Barbican, starring Cillian Murphy. Meanwhile, his second novel is out, Lanny, a tale of rural England, a land of modernity and yet mythical gods, and the disappearance of a young boy. George Berridge is a fan of both this week, calling the play a wild and dizzying microcosm of mourning. Very nice phrase. And the novel a dazzling ode to nature and the act of creation. He's here to make good those words of praise. George, hello.
Hello.
So let's start with Lanny, which I have read half of.
You sound surprised with yourself.
Well, I am a little. So I'm really interested in what you've said. George, how's it built? How's it structured? How does it work, the book?
So, well, like with his debut, Grief, this is a relatively slim novel set into three acts. And yet this time they are all kind of narratively distinct. The first introduces us to this small, quite quaint, but very, very English village on the kind of outside of the commuter belt. I mean, you're thinking of sort of oak trees and a cricket club and people who care a lot about whether their ale is real. And we find here a family just moved there. We find Jolie, the mother, who is a once actress and now a kind of gory crime writer. And we have a husband, Robert, who is a kind of banker of sorts who works in the city. And we have their child, the titular character, Lanny. Also, we have an aging, kind of eccentric artist called Pete, or Mad Pete by those in the town, with whom Lanny strikes up a friendship. And then we have the presence of this sort of voyeur of the area, who is called Dead Papa Toothwort.
But he's not real, is he?
Well.
Or is he?
There is, as with Crow from Max Porter's first book, there is a certain element of ambiguity here, which I think we're supposed to enjoy.
Yeah. But he's kind of a mythical man of the woodsy, panny type creature.
Yes, there is. Yeah, I was thinking, as I was reading this the first time around, there is a certain distinct element of kind of things like Pan's Labyrinth or A Monster Calls, that he is this kind of
Geist. He kind of lives
yeah.
in the elements of the landscape and kind of watches as everything goes on.
Well, and he doesn't just watch, though. He's a trickster figure.
No, well, quite. He is this kind of mischief maker. And
Puckish,
yes. He's not... he isn't a kind of malign. He isn't really malevolent, and yet he is reluctant to see things remain kind of dead and uninteresting. He wants things to change and he wants things to happen, and so he manufactures what happens in the second and third act, and then he disappears from the narrative.
And the story is constructed as a series of voices, isn't it? So it's you get the mum's voice, the dad's voice.
Yes. So in the first, what we'll call act of the book, you have the voices of the mother, the father, Mad Pete, and Dead Papa Toothwort. Lanny himself actually has no voice. And yet when we move into the second act, little fragments start to appear. So names disappear and you just take up voices from around the town. And it's only in the third act, when the kind of the narrative becomes more straight and free-flowing, the form becomes more straight, that things get really wild and phantasmagorical and sort of hallucinatory. So I quite like how he's played with that.
You do love this book, don't you?
I do. I think it's brilliant.
Dead Papa Toothwort, this is what I found annoying, but this could be my lack of heightened taste here. Dead Papa Toothwort, when he talks, the words literally move and on the page they come off lines. There's sort of a poetical, very poetical yeah. feeling about them. And it sort of acts as a sort of poetical commentary to the action of the village itself.
Yes, that's right. Yes, very much in the same way. As I write in the piece, there is a clear kind of paying of respect here to Dylan Thomas's radio play Under Milkwood. And so Dead Papa Toothwort serves the same purpose as the main voice here. And so through him, we hear these kind of fragments of kind of conversations and thoughts and gossip and dreams. And we hear all of this kind of going on. And we see these fragments of things happening on the pages. They weave and they overlap and they wall and they kind of, as you say, kind of they cut off the edge of the page. And through this, and I don't think that this is any sort of postmodern I don't think it's kind of smart kind of ergodic stuff. This isn't kind of quite like something like, let's say, House of Leaves. And I think that this is all very much part of kind of Max Warder, I think, is very clever about how he works with form and function. I think that this is all very deliberate. I mean, the book is, as I write, it is very heavily focused on things like creation and on playfulness and inventiveness. And this is really important to both Lanny and the artist character, Mad Pete. And so I think that having this kind of freedom with form on the page, I think, is really crucial in kind of developing that idea.
It's a sense of kind of contained chaos.
Yeah, I think that's a really good way of saying it.
Is it significant, this book? Do you think this is going to be... I kind of get the feeling with him, he feels like quite a major figure in Genesis, Max Porter. Is that fair? That, you know, he's now done two books, both of which are interesting and beautiful and well thought out and slight. And, you know, it feels like he's becoming a thing.
Yeah, I think that... I mean, I would hope so. I think that he is a writer of real, real brilliance and talent. And I think that what he does with Lanny so well is that there is none of this book that feels very very obvious. There is nothing here. I mean, there are themes that you can pick up on, so, and this is discussed via these kind of fragments of overheard conversation. There's nothing very obvious about kind of Brexit or the state of the nation or environmentalism.
Thank
none of
God.
This stuff is none of this stuff is discussed in a kind of very obvious way, a kind of way that it could be. And I think this is really clever, and I think this is interesting. And yes, I think you're right. I think that Max Porter is having somewhat of a kind of Midas moment. It's interesting that on the day of publication for Lanny, they announced the film has already been announced.
Wow.
With Rachel Weisz starring as Lanny's mother. Uh-huh. And he's already announced that he's working on a third book.
Wow.
So if there are shares going, Max Porter, I would say now is the time to buy.
Buy.
I love that.
But so this Lanny does represent a significant step from Grief is the Thing.
Yes, I think so. I think that this
is... much more plot. There's a lot more going on, a lot more...
There is, and I think that this is a less raw, and it is slightly less... I slightly hesitate to use the word focus, but it is a slightly more developed work. I think that Grief was written as a kind of later life response to something that actually happened to Max Porter. I mean, his father died when he was very young, and it has a real cutting emotional edge, Grief, that is. And Lanny, I think, is a... like Max Porter is now, it is a more mature work. There is more going on here.
It reminded me a bit of, I don't know if you've read Reservoir 13, the John McGregor book.
I have started reading it as part of reading this, and so many people have said, oh, you should read Reservoir 13.
And it is a bit like that, because the way he wrote that, John McGregor, is he wrote a series of stories about each character, and then he cut them up physically and stuck them together. And so it reads like a series of voices. And you get a bit of a sense of that in this. It's sort of a village set of voices. You get a community sense. And the idea of a slightly sort of rural mysticism is around there.
Yeah, and Dead Papa Toothwell has this. There is this lovely, very brief quote that he says. He calls it his English symphony. Yeah. He's listening to the kind of the sounds and voices of the town, which I rather like.
Yeah, that's very good. Now, how do you turn poetic, very beautiful, intricate novel writing into a play?
Well, I think that Enda Walsh has done a really brilliant job, and the play is on at the Barbican. It's having a relatively short run before moving on to New York, and I think that he's done a really brilliant job of bringing this to life. I think that it is set basically on a pretty stark stage, and yet with some really amazing lighting and projection work, they build on this kind of the poetic elements of Porter. So you see, within the first act, you see this kind of scrawling, you see the Dickinson from which the book takes its title kind of etched across the back, and you see these words and interjections start to kind of display on the back. And I think that he does a really good job of displaying the form of the book in its first instance. And I think that he's done a really good job with Cillian Murphy. I mean, they've worked together a number of times, and I think that he is a really, really astounding performer in this.
Because it sounds, at one level, again, to not make this tricksy when you have poetry being projected, and the crow, presumably, who is a sort of figure in that, how does he become manifest on a play?
Well, so, yes, you're right. I mean, as with Toothwell, there is a sort of ambiguity, especially in the book, as to how real Crow is. Is Crow a real physical manifestation who comes and visits, or is he kind of a sign, a kind of interior madness of the father who's kind of become real in a sense? So how to put this on is a bit of a challenge.
Yeah.
If you're Enda Walsh, you watch Cillian Murphy, who plays the father, recently widowed, and he kind of shuffles. He has this kind of old haggard dressing gown, and he kind of shuffles and ambles around the stage. And yet when Crow appears, the hood comes up and it covers most of his face, and you see this kind of big thick grin appear from underneath it, and there's a microphone concealed up his sleeve, and suddenly this great thick booming voice appears, and he becomes Crow. He comes all kind of, his arms are flat back like wings, and it's brilliant. It's a really astounding performance. It's very, very physical. There's a lot of leaping and bounding. I mean, I was really impressed. I mean, he clams and leaps straight up to the desk and onto the bunk beds, which was impressive, and I respect him for that.
That's all I want in a play, is someone the athletic ability of all the actors.
And I was saying to a friend after I watched this, I don't remember if you've seen the Lord of the Rings films. There's a moment
Thea's nodding enthusiastically there. Noted.
Where Gandalf, in an attempt to scare Bilbo, who is hiding the ring from him, there's a moment where they're in Bag End, this tiny little cottage, and he looms all of a sudden above. Yeah. He says, "Do you take me to this conjurer of cheap tricks?" And he suddenly looms and he becomes massive, and then he shrinks back down again. He becomes, "But I'm trying to be your friend." And there's a certain
Shadow
element of that to
stuff.
It.
Mm.
Yeah, quite.
I'm trying to work out how popular Max Porter is. I mean, because getting a play, getting a Rachel Weisz-led movie,
going from a short run in Dublin last year, I think it
Dublin
was, to to this here at the Barbican, and then leapfrogging from that straight to New York.
What do we say? I mean, are people?
Yeah,
is he a household name? I mean, what's his...
I don't think he's a household name yet, but he should be. I mean,
quite.
You think he will be?
I would hope so. I mean, I think that he is a really interesting, inventive writer, and I think that what he is doing at the moment shows that there's a kind of real evolution in what he's doing. I mean, he said that he's writing a third book, so I can't wait to see what he does with it.
Yeah. And is he sort of awardy? Is that sort of... Is this going to be bookery, do we feel?
I think it... I'd be surprised if Lanny wasn't in for a bunch of awards.
Really, I've just been talking about Sally Rooney's book, and it's amazing that wasn't nominated for Normal People shortlist on the Booker. I just wonder, is there a feel that this is another youngish person on the rise?
Well, Booker do also seem to be making a concerted effort to be more wide-ranging in terms of what they cover. So
yeah, I thought that was a sort
coming
of,
in, and this is much more playful in terms of what it is.
Yeah, I mean, whether to start to speculate on the book as a whole, kettle of fish and yeah, a whole sort of bag of worms, and yeah, kettle of fish, bag
a kettle of worms,
kettle of worms, and but yes, I think that was a slightly distinct choice by the booker not to include the extremely popular normal people on their shortlist, and perhaps it'll be the same with Lanny, but I hope it's not. I think it. And it deserves all the success it
could
gets.
Could people who like genre fiction, could people who aren't used to literary fiction, if that word actually has any meaning, that phrase has any meaning, do you feel they could read this happily?
Yeah, I don't think that they're... I think that it's not a book that is trying to show off how clever it is. It is just a clever book. But I think that it's both accessible, and I think that anyone who wasn't moved by this might have a particularly cold heart.
Stig, were you moved by this?
Yes, I was moved by it. That's all for this week. Our thanks go to George Berridge, Alice Block and Shauneen Lamb. Get a copy of our lovely tech paper, printed anachronistically on dead trees or sent direct to your digital brain. Next week, Shakespeare. You don't talk about him very much, Thea. Thea, I think you could look a little more enthusiastic about the greatest writer of the English language ever.
I was just holding my breath for some reason. Oh, really? And I just hadn't exhaled
okay.
Well.
Should we get Michael Caine's in to
of
talk
course.
About it? The doctor will be in the house. Until then, from Thea and from me, goodbye.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.